You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Matt Gallagher.
World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world settings safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love, and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 250,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Matt Gallagher on the show with me today. He has a phenomenal new book. It's called Empire City, and this definitely needs to be on your summer reading list if it's not already. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Hank. Looking forward to the conversation.
Absolutely. Matt, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, gosh. It's a good question. My very first memory probably goes back to fourth or fifth grade and getting from my mom the Lord of the Rings trilogy for Christmas. And we'd read The Hobbit at school, and I'd liked it. But the Lord of the Rings is such a broader, bigger, darker story than The Hobbit. And I spent my entire winter break that year just roaring through those books, so addicted to it that I'd sit in the bathtub and read it because I couldn't pry myself away. Those ages are so formative for us all, of course, but it just sparked my imagination and I think the creativity within me to want to do something like that, to connect with people that I'd never meet through story, through characters that were passed from the mind of Tolkien to kids like me all over the world. And so, I think that that was a fundamental change on me as a young person.
I wish I could total up the amount of authors that I've talked to who were first inspired by Tolkien. It's unreal, that he would be the gateway drug for so many people.
That's exactly what he is.
It's so crazy. And you're totally right about the tonal shift between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. But there's something about The Lord of the Rings that inspires greatness, wants to make us tell stories of epic proportions. And I guess that's why he's the king of epic fantasy.
there you go. Yeah, it's not just the story, it's the history behind his world. It's each character gets dimensionality in multitudes. I think that's just so important for writers of any age to keep in mind.
Were you one of the kids that started imagining your own fictional world after that and populating it with characters?
Very much so, though they were all, of course, pretty obvious ripoffs of Tolkien type characters. But I had notebooks full of spinoffs or sequels that I was playing with, and I probably still keep notes in a very similar disordered fashion. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Did you start writing down these stories, do you remember the first short story that you wrote, or the first attempt at a novel where this was a serious endeavor for you?
Oh gosh, yeah, I think the summer between high school and college, I was on a big F. Scott Fitzgerald kick.
Yeah.
And he achieved greatness at such a young age. And I think The Side of Paradise, he wrote it like 20 or 21. I mean, something ridiculous. So I was feeling very old at 18. I was like, man, I really got to get on it. I wrote just a truly terrible book of autofiction based on my youth growing up in Reno, Nevada. But I finished it. And that was not nothing. It felt like a big accomplishment at the time, and it was, because it was seeing, sitting down and, I don't know, maybe 120, 130 pages double-spaced seemed like a momentous thing back then. It was, an act of creation, and it was hugely important to me as a developing writer. Even though I've definitely burned every page or trace of it, just in case, because it was as indulgent can be as many works produced by 18-year-olds are.
Well, but you brought up a great point, and I think the most important point of that whole exercise was that you got through it. It was a finished work. You got from beginning to end, and you landed it. If you had 100 people in a room and you asked those 100 people, how many of you think you have a story inside you? Almost all hands would go up. We all want to tell stories. It's something innate and built into us. But then if you come back a year later and ask those 100 people, how many of you started on it, there would maybe be 10 hands. And right. if you asked them how many finished what you started, probably almost none, if one, would have finished something like that. So I think that is a huge accomplishment for a writer. The act of getting through it from beginning to end, I think does more for writer's confidence and honestly for the skill of writing, then we're all just honing those skills for the rest of our life and sharpening those points. But man, is that a huge accomplishment for a writer, just getting through that first one.
100% agree. Yeah. It's, you got to put in the work. It's a job. And, I'm with you. Like, everybody on this planet has a story and a compelling story to tell, but that is not at all the same thing as being a writer. Being a writer means putting in the work.
That's right. That's right. That was the summer between high school and college. What did you decide to go to college for?
Because I was doing Army ROTC which was paying for my school, but it also meant I had a job right after college. I was kind of allowed to really study what I wanted. So I majored in both history and English. My college didn't have a creative writing major, though it did offer creative writing classes that went towards my English major. So it was, it was really developmental for me to kind of take those things simultaneously. I mean, one of the most formative classes I took at Wake Forest was a class on 1930s American literature focused on the Great Depression. That was kind of merging those interests of history and of literature, showing how these, you know, this big world event, that we'd all grown up hearing about, the Great Depression, that our grandparents had endured as young people, being told through story of everyday lives, you know, whether it was Steinbeck or it was the first time I read All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, which was hugely transformative in terms of political literature on a young engaged politically engaged mind. That class in particular, and those years in general, really kind of lit a fire in me in terms of wanting to figure out a way of melding history, whether recent or distant in the past, with storytelling. And because there's just a way, when done well, it can make these kind of the dreary past come alive to people that otherwise wouldn't necessarily care what's happening. Whether it's the Iraq War from the last decade, or something like Huey Long decades and decades ago in Louisiana. When done right, that intersection of history and literature is incredibly special and transformative for writers and readers alike.
You mentioned the ROTC. Was this a lifelong dream to join the Army, to sign up, to be a military man, or was this kind of out of necessity, to go to college? And no judgment there. I know when I asked that question, it probably sounded that way, but. Was this a lifelong dream, or for you, or what prompted you to join the ROTC and sign up for the military?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say it was a lifelong dream. I was really kind of a goofy, dreamy kid. The patriarch of my family was my grandfather, who was a retired Navy admiral who'd fought in World War II in Korea. I had an uncle who fought in Vietnam, and then both my parents protested Vietnam. So, it was always an option, because it, for financial reasons, but also for family reasons.
Sure.
But it was never forced upon me or pressed upon me. It felt like a good way to pay for school. It felt like a good way to, it was something that adults, seemed impressed by when they asked what I wanted to do, after college. I wanted to go do something with myself. I wanted to be a writer of the world someday. And joining the military was one way to do that. Now, granted, this was right before 9/11. So when I envisioned what that meant, it was a very different
landscape.
Exactly. Yeah, than what ended up happening. It just kind of checked all the boxes. But no, was I Mr. Gung Ho? Was I a G.I. Joe kid? I was very much anything but.
Well, I think I'm probably just a little bit older than you, but not much. And I remember, as a kid, go see the world, join the Army. That was a slogan, and that was a legitimate. We were in relative peacetime, and I know lots of people that, they traveled the world and they got to see things and come back and tell the rest of us what the big world is like out there. And as a writer or someone who aspired to tell stories and to see the world and show people the world through your eyes, that is absolutely, that's probably what I would have done as well. When did you ship off? Was it after 9/11?
I was a freshman in college when 9/11 happened. Really, I think it was maybe my second week of school, and I was so new to it all that I didn't know anything. I barely knew how to tie my boots. But we had a pre-planned ROTC meeting that evening, and I remember walking to it that night thinking, oh my gosh, are we going to Afghanistan? I've only shot a gun maybe twice in my life. That is not how it works. for any listeners unfamiliar with the military world, luckily, So I, you know, spent the next 4 years finishing college, and was commissioned as an Army second lieutenant upon graduation in 2005. And then, was sent to do, my military training, my officer training after that, and, ended up going to Iraq, in charge of a 30-man scout platoon in late 2007.
Wow. So what job did you do in the Army?
Yeah. So, I was commissioned as a armored cavalry officer. So, you know, training wise, at least basic doctrine, we're supposed to do kind of the same mission as the old horse cavalry. We were trained on a lot of reconnaissance, you know, going out in front of the main forces, the infantry and their artillery, and scouting out where enemy positions are, where, you know, the big rivers are, the big natural geographical landscapes, that kind of thing. Of course, by the time we got to Iraq in late 07, the war did not need much of any of that. We were fighting an insurgency. So we really kind of became a jack of all trades, master of none. Were assigned, my company was assigned to a sectarian town northwest of Baghdad called Sabah al-Bor. And General David Petraeus had recently taken over, shifted the strategy to a more counterinsurgency approach, which meant, you know, we lived in this town, kind of at this outpost. The idea being, you know, we were trying to build everything back up. We were trying to stabilize the electricity. We were handing out business grants to local small businesses. We were trying to track down the insurgents, both Shia and Sunni, that were living amongst the population. That got tricky, of course, when you realize that a number of those insurgents are the, you know, late teenage boys, not too much younger than many of my soldiers, honestly, of some of those business owners, of some of those local members of the city council. You know, everything was so intermingled. So, you know, you just took it one day, one night at a time. Sometimes that meant, you know, a really hard kinetic raid, guns up, expecting to be shot back at. Other times it was literally go hang out at a local sheikh's house, drink chai, eat a big meal, and talk history, talk the area. You know, not too different, frankly, in many ways than being a beat cop. It was a very formative time, and I know it seems quaint now, given how things have shaken out over there since. But when we came home in early 2009, things were a little bit better. And you know, I can't speak for the whole war effort, because it went sour quickly. That's a terrible thing, especially for the Iraqi people. But when we returned in our little corner of Babylon, we felt like maybe things were a little bit better than we found it.
Matt, we know that war changes people, and it changes your perspective, especially in a counterinsurgency type situation where you are so close with people and with communities. As a writer, because that's what we focus here on the show, how do you feel like this war experience changed you, and do you feel like that it made you more empathetic to the people that you met or the people that you encountered, their stories that you can then share with the rest of the world?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Being in that kind of environment, you know, you got to know people in a way that people, the American soldiers who'd been there a few years before me probably hadn't. You know, the dynamic was always affected by the fact that we were strange foreigners with guns in their living room. I won't pretend otherwise. But in terms of that dimensionality I mentioned earlier, the multitudes, the stories, the histories, you know, it was all there. Understanding, hey, if I were a 18-year-old kid suffering, whose family was suffering economic hardship, and saw these jokers from across the sea walking through my town, I'd be upset too. You know, in that job, there's limits to that empathy, but, you know, a real formative memory I still have that I've, used a few different times in different forms in my writing. One of those tribal sheiks, that I mentioned earlier, had us over for a big lunch. And you know, he was a man of violence. You could just tell by the way he carried himself that he'd been through a lot. Some of it perhaps directed at American forces at some point. But at this point in 2008, he was an ally. And, you know, he called me over and my platoon sergeant over and showed us some portraits on his wall. They were family portraits. And he pointed at kind of an oil painting and said that was through a translator. He said, that's my great-grandfather. He was here when the British came through. Claimed to have met Lawrence of Arabia. Then he pointed to an old black and white photo and said, that's my grandfather. He fought the Ottomans. Then he pointed to a more recent photo, looked just like him. The photo, the color was a bit dated. He said, that was my dad. He helped overthrow the king and install the Ba'athist Party, which is where Saddam Hussein came from. And you know, he didn't follow up on it. Framed it as just wanted to, you know, show us these men that had mattered to him, that he carried in his heart. But you know, it didn't take a genius, I think, to pick up on the subtext of what he was trying to convey to my platoon sergeant and I, which is. This is temporary for you all. I know that. I'm following a long family tradition of working with or working against foreigners. But this is my home. These are my people. You'll go home, and I will still, the fight will go on. And yeah, that memory stuck with me for a long time, both as a person and especially as a writer.
So you come home, around 2009, I believe you said. How do you start acclimating yourself back to civilian life? And as a lifelong writer and storyteller, how long does it take for these experiences you've had to start coming out in things that you were sharing with people?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was very lucky because I kept a blog over there, and my first book, a nonfiction book. Was based on that blog. So I was able to kind of channel these very fresh and recent memories and experiences into that, thinking, okay, well, that's it. That, you know, that's, these are my war stories here. You know, love it or leave it. Here you go. And it certainly helped me make sense of our experiences as a writer and as a thinker. It forced me to, some uncomfortable places and uncomfortable conclusions. But at the time I thought, okay, well that's that. Now I'm going to go write the next thing, write something else. But you know, that's not how things work, not just with war, but, with, you know, with any formative experience, right?
Sure.
Whether it's an old romance, our families, whatever the subject is, they stay with us. They linger in us. They change with time. Our relationship changes to it as we get older. I think I've become far more melancholic about our war since I wrote my first nonfiction book, because I've seen how it's played out on the macro scale, right? Like I mentioned earlier, when I was writing in 2010, there was still a possibility, maybe not for peace, but at least some level of sustained calm in Iraq, in particular part of Iraq, central Iraq that we were in. The last decade has changed that tremendously, right? We're now seeing young men and women born after 9/11 joining the military. We're now seeing young Iraqi kids, those memories of little children I have of passing out chocolates or Beanie Babies, many of those kids are now carrying guns over there in many ways. So, you know, that's a specific and long-winded way of saying that, you know, the subjects, the themes that we find as writers early in our lives, I think this goes for every writer, mine happens to be this, will stick with us for many years. You know, that doesn't mean the stories should be the same or the approaches should be the same. But I think it's okay and more than okay to keep revisiting these ideas, these themes, these subjects. I mean, hey, nobody told Joyce that he should stop writing about Ireland. Right? Nobody told Toni Morrison she should stop writing about the African American experience. So you know, that will I probably be writing about the war on terror and for again? Yeah, I will. And some of that is rooted in my own experiences in Iraq, but you know, some of it's just maybe rooted in my interest in it as a citizen these days.
Right. So Matt, what brought you around to write fiction? Empire City is a novel. It's not based in reality, although, as we all know, it's informed by your experiences. What brought you around to writing fiction?
I think I'm one of those writers that finds fiction to be ultimately more challenging, but ultimately more fulfilling, both as a reader and as a writer. I think there's just deeper emotional truths that can be mined in fiction that the hard confines of nonfiction sometimes don't allow for. Though, you know, of course, there are some exceptions. You know, after my first book, I was trying my hand at fiction for those very same reasons, and it just wasn't coming out right. So, you know, I just kept at it and let it grow. And, you know, my first novel was about Iraq set a few years after I was there myself. And then, you know, I wanted to do something else. I wanted to reach other readers. You know, something about this subject for even very smart, very literary people. You know, I've seen it a lot. Sometimes you'll see the light go out in their eyes, and you know, there are political reasons for that. There are very understandable humanist reasons for that, right? These things matter. I think they matter a lot to me as a writer, as a thinker, as a citizen of a republic. So, you know, I was trying to come up with ways to reach more readers to maybe wrestle with some of these questions that I think are really vital. And I started thinking, I was like, I want to write, how about an alternate history, right? Like, so you can just get super weird, create your own world, set it in an alternate United States, so readers aren't put off by, you know, the quote-unquote war parts, even though this United States has turned out differently because of a foreign war. I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And, you know, started kind of taking a look at the classics of the genre. The Man in the High Castle, of course. You know, what if the Nazis won? Bring the Jubilee. What if the South won? And I was like, well, what's something that maybe hasn't been super done and explored? And you know, for I mentioned earlier, you know, how important the Vietnam War was to my family in different ways. I was like, well, you know, what is it about America that in my opinion, kind of makes this a bashful empire, right? A lot of that goes back to Vietnam and what occurred there. And you know, what if I created a world set contemporarily,
easy for you to say.
I got there eventually. Set a world in where we're living now, but that never occurred, right? That somehow, some way, and eventually landed on the idea of a foreign legion fighting Vietnam for us, that we never reckoned with the fallout from the Vietnam War as a society, as a country. Teasing that out, what I landed on is, well, in America, more in the ancient Rome model would have resulted. In America, more in the high British model would have resulted, open and proud about its imperialism. That's okay. That's fucked up and dark. I can say that, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, all right. I should have checked earlier.
It's okay.
That's really dark. What does that look like for everyday people? And you know, ended up creating the characters that populate Empire City as a result. Some of them are everyday citizens, just trying to get by. Some are soldiers from this openly Imperial America, returning home and finding it as many Roman and British soldiers from yesteryear did, finding it a really strange and warped, distorted place than they remembered it being, just had a lot of fun with it. I mean, the world building was very unlike anything I'd done before in my previous work. But it was once I got it right, it was ultimately the most fulfilling part of the creative process as well.
So, Matt, as you start going through the what if stage, and you know, there's lots of different ways that a novel begins, but one of those is when the writer just starts playing these what if exercises, and it sounds like you went all through that. And as your world starts to emerge, and the world building, for lack of a better term, starts going on, when do you start populating this world with people? Because, you know, we read for lots of reasons, and one of those is for engaging plots. One is for dynamic settings that we can really get lost in. But what keeps us in those settings are larger than life characters, three-dimensional characters that jump off the page at us. How do you start populating this world with characters?
It's a great point, Hank. I wanted this to be a character-driven novel, both because that's what I'm drawn to as a reader, but also because I thought that, you know, that's the way that I think books like this work, right? It's not just the world itself, but it's you know, showing readers how the characters' everyday lives are different than theirs, right? And that can only come from robust, engaging characters who are in the process of being transformed. You know, there's three protagonists in Empire City. Probably the first one that I developed, and he's the character readers first meet, is Sebastian Rios, who's kind of a young, brooding bureaucrat, government bureaucrat, who was a journalist taken hostage overseas and kind of miraculously survived and is still wrestling with a lot of post-traumatic stress from those events. You know, he's bashful and shy, but there is a lot of hidden courage in there, though it takes a while to be revealed. The second character is Mia Tucker, who is a former helicopter pilot turned Wall Street financier. You know, Mia was really important for me to be part of this story because, you know, a lot of contemporary fiction about war, quote unquote war, is about men, right? Men in the, I've been a part of this in my previous work. You sure. know, men who served in the infantry, went over as idealists and came home scarred by their experiences, and that's tried and true tradition, and justifiably so. But Mia, I think, represents a big part of the modern veteran community that hasn't gotten a lot of treatment in literature just yet, which is not just a woman officer, but somebody that really found herself in the military, isn't necessarily scarred by her experiences. Mia had to leave the military because of a helicopter crash, and she lost her leg. And when we first are introduced to her in Empire City, she's longing to return. She simply can't physically anymore. You know, that's a different approach and a different mind frame than I think a lot of literary readers are accustomed to. And then the third character, who's probably my favorite character to develop and to write and to follow his journey, is a young man named Jean-Jacques St. Preux. He's a Haitian immigrant who joined the military to earn his American citizenship. In this world, the American Foreign Legion, to fill its ranks, to be able to fight all these the multitude of imperial wars that are being waged in this world, have done this in the French Foreign Legion model. Because the American middle class isn't willing to serve in the numbers needed to sustain this. So Jean-Jacques is is a decorated U.S. Army Ranger. He joined the military for citizenship, but also transformed himself and is returning home for the first time since joining the military, returning home to his Haitian community in this world's New York City, and finding it very different than how he left it, and is wrestling with suppressed memories of who he was before he joined the army. And you know that's maybe, I think he was important to me both because I wanted a counterbalance to Sebastian and Mia on a story level, but also to kind of represent the enlisted forces, the quote unquote blue collar folks that make up the military that do the everyday grind, right? Not everybody, though. The war literature might suggest otherwise. Not everybody is a junior, a dreamy junior officer, right? somebody has to do the hard grunt work. And, right. And Jean-Jacques is a man from that background and a proud one as well.
Well, Matt, this book is a thrilling read. I mean, this reads like I'm trying to categorize it. It's such a fun ride. Emotional roller coaster from beginning to end. When readers finish this book and they close the back cover, what do you hope they're left with?
Uncomfortable questions more than anything, Hank.
Yeah.
It's
you're left with quite a few.
Good. Well, mission accomplished. I wanted this to be an engaging story with sharp, dynamic characters, but I more than anything, I want readers to remember that these matters of war and peace belong to us all. That in our world, our soldiers wear the American flag and represent us all. And more these things feel separate and apart from us. And I totally get why. There are real understandable reasons for that. Life is hard enough here and now than to think too much, to dwell constantly on what's happening on the other side of the world. On the other hand, that's our duty as thinking people. That's our duty as citizens of a republic. And Empire City is a story, I think, in many ways of a world where that's gotten too far away, where things go wrong in the ancient Roman model of where, this is what can happen when the military gets too far apart from the republic it serves. I don't want to give too much away, but there are elements, antagonistic elements in this book that are pushing for a military coup, and that propels a lot of the plot of the book, I think. And in this world, those antagonistic forces have their reasons. I don't agree with them. But as a writer, I needed to make them believable to those characters and to the reader. And my great hope to get back to answering your question is that as readers finish that last page and put this on their bookshelf, they think to themselves, okay, how do we do better? How can on an everyday level, just as a person, as a voter, how can I help do better? And then also, of course, I hope they're like, oh, I can't wait to share this with my friends.
Right. Well put. Matt Gallagher, the book is called Empire City. There's a link to it in the show notes of this episode. Matt, if people are wanting to find out more about all the great stuff that you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a website, mattgallagherwriter.com. I'm probably too active on Twitter, to be honest with you. So you can find me there. I'm at Matt Gallagher Zero. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook. So feel free to reach out. I love to chat books and literature with readers.
And we'll link up all of that in the show notes as well. Matt, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, appreciate it, Hank. Thanks for having me.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website
your home on the web where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.